Welcome to the Darrell McClain Show. I'm your host, Darrell McClain, and let's get into our episode.
Simply search for the T-Bone and Chick Brew podcast, available wherever fine podcasts are sold.
The Darrell McClain Show is fully listener-supported, independent media that won't lead you to tribalism. You can get a membership for as little as $3 a month at www.patreon.com/TheDarrellMcClain Show.
We talk about a lot of serious topics on this show. One very serious topic is women's health. One company that stood out to me was VSlay.com because the owner is very transparent about her own struggles in the women's health department and has great customer service, great deals, and frequent sales. You can check her out, her great customer service, products about women's health, and frequent sales at www.VSlay.com. That is www.VSlay.com.
Of course, remember the show is listener funded, so you can support us by going to www.patreon.com and getting a membership for as little as $3 a month. The quote of the day is an anonymous quote, and it's going to be, "The most oppressed are usually the most distracted." Again, the most oppressed are usually the most distracted. Welcome to the Darrell McClain Show. So let's start off with some economics. Workers are picking up extra jobs just to pay for gas and food. Now, prices are rising faster than wages, and more Americans, more than ever, are working two full-time jobs simultaneously. Now, this is coming from the Washington Post. Albert Elliott has been fueling up his Kia Soul in increments of $15, $20, and $25 to make the 60-mile commute from Fayetteville, North Carolina, to an Amazon warehouse in Raleigh, North Carolina, where he makes $15.75 an hour. Lately, he doesn't have enough gas to fill up that entire tank. In June, gas prices had gotten so steep that Elliott took a second job as a janitor at a community college, working an extra 2 days a week for $10 an hour. Gas is just through the roof unless it's payday. I put all the money I had at the time, sometimes borrowing money from family and friends, Elliott said. I began to realize that what I was making at Amazon was not enough to pay for gas. My biggest concern is not being able to get to work to make any money. You have to be pretty much rob Peter to pay Paul. Now, a tight labor market has pushed wages up across the board, but not enough to keep up with the pace of inflation, which hit a 40-year high in June. That forces workers like Elliott to seek second jobs to increase the hours of pay for their normal expenses. The percentage of employed people working multiple jobs in the United States has steadily increased since March of 2020 from 4% in April of 2020 to 4.8% in June of 2022. Now, this is according from data from the St. Louis Federal Reserve, although it has not returned to its pre-pandemic levels. In February of 2020, for example, 5.1% of workers in the United States held two or more jobs, while people taking on multiple jobs is a typical sign of a healthy job market where workers have more job opportunities available. It's also a sign of increasing financial strain on American pocketbooks. Now, there are people who want multiple jobs to make more money. And they find that opportunity when the labor market is stronger, said Nick Bunker, director of economic research at Indeed's Hiring Lab. But I would say for many people, the urgency of finding more income or a second job or a third job has intensified with inflation. Workers are increasingly taking on second full-time jobs and clocking more than 70 hours a week to make ends meet. Although fewer people overall have multiple jobs now than before the pandemic, more workers now hold two full-time jobs, defined as more than 35 hours per week. That in any point since the Bureau of Labor Statistics began collecting data on this in 1994. 426,000 Americans held 426,000 Americans held two full-time jobs in June compared to 308,000 in February of 2022. So people most hurt by high inflation are also seeing a ton of job growth, said Heidi Schilholz, president of the Economic Policy Institute, a left-leaning think tank. Given the burden of high inflation, a high job availability is not at all a surprise to me that you see people doubling up on jobs. End quote. Wages grew faster last year than they have in any decade, with the biggest gains for low-wage workers in leisure and hospitality, who had a newfound leverage to negotiate higher pay, quit their jobs, and unionize. Their hourly average earners were up 5.1% over the past year, according to the government data from June. But for most workers, even the lowest pay sectors where wages are rising fastest, inflation is now wiping out pay increases. Soaring prices meant overall wages fell by 3.6% when adjusted for inflation over the past year, the BLS data showed. The June jobs report showed cooling wage growth after months of strong gains, and which is sometimes an indicator of an economy headed toward a recession. So wages are up, but inflation canceled out any gains. Average hourly earnings for private sector jobs changed from earlier this year. So there still should be people who are getting raises faster than inflation, but they're not nearly as many as a few months ago, according to Bunker. People who said my raises are outpacing inflation are not saying I'm no longer getting those raises because of inflation. So the cost of essentials like gas, food, and rent have especially skyrocketed as inflation rose, according to the BLS report. That has disproportionately hurt low-wage workers, who typically suffer most from high inflation because they devote a higher share of their income to those expenses, which are harder to cut back on. Hermes Dyes, an independent contractor in the construction industry in Queens, took a second job in May as a commercial cleaner because of rising gas prices and fewer opportunities for work in residential construction. Now, these days, he cobbles together cleaning and construction gigs, amounting to get to be between 60 and 90 hours a week of work to pay his rent and his daughter's college tuition. Quote, I can't buy the same things I used to buy, Diaz said in Spanish, even really cheap clothes and fruit. The type of rice, eggs are too expensive. I have other priorities. I'm buying a lot less, but I am spending more money. Now, Anisha Williams, a 37-year-old single mother in Los Angeles who makes $16.25 an hour, has a home care provider, picked up a second job as a driver through cashier at the Jack in the Box last year to pay her bills. Last month, her landlord raised her rent by $130 to $1,730 a month for a two-bedroom. Now she signs up for extra bonus, extra hours at the Jack in the Box, any opportunity then she gets. So she goes on to say, I'm going through it right now. I'm on the verge of becoming homeless, she said. Sometimes I have to put my phone bill on extension. I put the gas and electric bill on extension. When prices at the 99-cent store going up, you know something is going on, end quote. Now, higher earnings, white-collar workers can't cut back on fuel costs by finding remote jobs that allow them to avoid commuting or move to cheaper cities. In June, a Quinnipiac poll found that 52% of Americans cut back significantly on how much they drove because of the rise in gas prices. but most workers don't have that option. A low-wage worker, especially in the hospitality and service industry, are more likely to be required to show up in person to do their jobs and spend heavily on gas. Even in 2021, when the pandemic was forcing closures more than it is now, only 13% of private sector workers in the United States did their jobs from home at all of the time. And 78% rarely or never work from home at all. Now, that was according to the BLS survey. Now, she goes on to say, and this is Ms. Williams, I put 25 in the tank on Monday. That didn't last long. This morning, I had to put another 15 bucks in the tank. Now, that was from Elliot, and they said on Wednesday, that got me to work today. I probably had to put another 20 in there to make it home tomorrow. I'm in Raleigh now at Amazon. When I leave, I have to go to my part-time cleaning job. And this is the nature of the U.S. economy right now. Now, I was reading something from Paul Krugman, Nobel Prize winning economist, Pulitzer Prize winner, blah, 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 where he was saying, postulating that the economic cycle right now makes absolutely no sense. And that's led people to believe that it's because it's obviously being manufactured. The inflation is going down in almost every other country currently, but it seems to be tinking up here. And that is most likely due to the fact that people are price gouging. So, of course, if you have the opportunity to do more remote work and work from home and not have to go in or quit. We had the great resignation. We had people retiring early. If you have that opportunity for you, then that's great. If you don't have that opportunity, you see what we see now, which is people actually having to get a second job in order to be able to go to work to afford the first job. That is a form of what I like to say they have right when they use the word late stage capitalism. You can't, the job you're working, you can't afford to get there. So you have to go work a second gig to get to the first gig. And I think I know a lot of people in this situation where 88-hour work week is just a normal thing to them. So it's always a problem when you see this happening. There's the Fed is going to try, it looks like, that the Fed is going to try to trigger some type of recession in order to cool down inflation. And they're all, of course, they're thinking about doing that because the person that is going to be hurt from that recession are the same people that have to get two and three jobs in order to make it to work, the gas in the car, etc. The rents is going up is something that we kind of saw coming on the back end when the landlords were not getting paid during the pandemic. I knew there was going to be something that pendulum was going to swing in the other direction. My biggest gripe with that is none of these things seem to be tied to each other enough to where it makes sense. You have a raise in wages and then they raise the rent. And you have a slight raise in wages, so then they raise the price of food, not luxury items or luxury goods, but your basics, rice, potatoes, and meat, dairy, and bread. And so even though you got those gains, $15 an hour is $30,000 a year, if anybody didn't know that. So you had the argument, the fight for 15. You had Joe Biden, when he came in office, pledged that he was that move to the $15 federal minimum wage, and you saw no movement on it. The federal minimum wage is still the exact same thing, and it's actually frustrating only because it's something that can be done tomorrow. And
stay with us. We'll be right back.
It goes without saying that this show does not happen without listener support. Support the Darrell McClain Show by going to www.patreon.com and getting a membership for $3. Or you can go to buzzsprouts.com/the Darrell McClain Show and hit the subscribe button and join there. Many ways to donate to the show. Independent media that won't reinforce tribalism. We have one planet. Nobody is leaving, so let us reason together. www.patreon.com/the Darrell McClain Show or go to Buzzsprouts and to the Darrell McClain Show and subscribe.
When you see people so out of touch that they don't make those moves, it makes you wonder why that's not happening. So, but there were good job numbers again. But I want to dig into those numbers and think about how many of those jobs are people, you know, taking on these multiple ones. We got a report today, talk about segues, but we got a report today from a officers from local, state, and federal agencies about how they all failed to take swift action to stop the deadly school shooting. And this is a report that came out of Texas. So the reporter's findings represented the most complete outside account of what took place during the 77 minutes between the gunmen began firing inside the classrooms and when the police finally stormed it and ended the massacre in Texas on May the 24th. So sadly, the report of the Uvalde shooting finds systemic failures in the police response. The decision to finally confront the gunmen was made by part of a group of officers and could have made far earlier if the report is true. So the first comprehensive assessment of law enforcement response to the deadly shooting in Uvalde, Texas found that blame for the failure to swiftly confront the gunmen rested not only with the school police chief, but also with the scores of the state and federal officials who gathered at the deadly scene, but did not act. The 77-page report released Sunday by a special Texas House committee represented a broad indictment of the police in action at the Robb Elementary School, citing systemic failures that left the school inadequately secured, and police officers who responded mired in confusion and bad information. Nearly 400 officers responded to the school that day. Yet, decision to finally confront the gunman was made by a small group of officers, including a specially trained Border Patrol agent and a deputy sheriff from a neighboring county, the report found, concluding that others at the scene could have taken charge and done so earlier. That's staggering. 400 people, one gunman, shooting elementary school children, 400 people stood in place and did nothing. 400 people did nothing for 77 minutes while one person was terrorizing an elementary school. That is an absolute disgrace. It makes you question that saying that they all say, only a good person with a gun can stop a bad person with a gun. I think we have to add some context with that. Maybe a good person with a gun who is not a coward, and maybe a good person with a gun who's willing to sacrifice himself for the life of others. When I was doing this type of work, I've said it before, this is not how we were trained. You were trained, but there's an active shooter situation. If you're the first on the scene, you respond. You go in. You go in. Even if you have to go in by yourself, you go in. I definitely can't imagine any situation where there would have been 4 of us, 10 of us, 20 of us, 30 of us, 100 of us, 200 of us, 300 of us, 400 of us standing still for 77 damn minutes and doing nothing. The findings represented the most complete outside account of what took place during the 77 minutes between when the gunman began firing inside the classroom and police finally stormed and ended the massacre that left 19 students and two teachers dead. But the report found that a flawless police response would not have saved most victims who suffered devastating injuries when they were shot with a high-powered AR-15-style rifle by a gunman who had been waiting for his 18th birthday to purchase the weapon legally. Imagine that. Yeah, talk about your goals and dreams. I can't wait till I turn 18 so I can go to the local elementary school and cause havoc. That is what the country's breeding right now. Some of the kids died on the way to the hospital, the report noted, adding in a final note that it is plausible that some victims could have survived had they not had to wait for 77 minutes to be rescued. Quote, if there's only one thing I can tell you, there were multiple systemic failures, State Representative Dustin Bowers, who spearheaded the investigation, said at a news conference on Sunday. Several officers in the hallway or in the building knew or should have known there were people dying in the classrooms. They should have done more, acted with urgency. Mr. Burroughs added that it would be up to the individual agencies to hold their officers accountable, which means the officers more than likely will not be held accountable. So the goal of the committee, he said, was to prove and to provide relatives of the victims and the public with the information. The officers waited the report even as the last ones ranking officials. The active chief of Uvalde Police Department learned that a teacher was wounded but still alive and that a child had been calling 911 for help inside the classroom. The committee found that none of the officers who learned of the calls advocated for shifting to an active shooter style response or otherwise acting more urgently to breach the classrooms. After the report came out, the mayor of Uvalde, Don McLullian, or whatever, said that the acting chief during the shooting, Lieutenant Maringo Pargas, had been placed on administrative leave and the city had begun its own internal investigation. The city released body camera footage documented the actions of the Uvalde officers at the scene. The facts laid out that the report also made clear that neither existing gun laws nor expanded background checks passed by Congress in response to the shooting would have prevented the gunman, Salvador Ramos, from obtaining the weapon he used. So that's kind of what I said in the Matthew McConaughey show. This is going to be an uncomfortable truth that you're going to have to wrestle with. And so I say it again. The facts out in the report also made clear that neither existing laws nor expanded background checks passed by Congress in the response to the shooting would have prevented the gunman from obtaining the weapon he used. So that means that you have to prepare yourself. This is going to happen again because the laws on the books cannot keep up with the criminals actively. The laws are always a response, and the response will never be good enough as a person wanting to commit the crime. Point one. Point two is the obvious that criminals don't care about the damn law. So that's where regulation comes in. You do have to stop the straw purchases, so on and so forth. But I think everybody knows, and it's a truism, that if you want to get your hands on something like a gun in America, if you are determined enough to do so, you will find a way to do it. And that is just part of the fabric of the way the society is shaped at the particular moment. So, though referred by some of the peers as a school shooter, the gunman had no documented history that prevented him from purchasing the weapon. The Republican-controlled Texas legislature has not so far considered any legislation restricting firearms responses to the Uvalde shooting, focusing much of his attention during public hearings on police responses and security at the schools. Now, while the narrative presented by the committee adding disturbing new details, it's substantially changed the public understanding of what took place at Robb Elementary Schools and what has been pieced together by the New York Times and other news organizations over the intervening weeks. Instead, it deepens the sense of rudderless law enforcement response. Officers massed on the north and south sides of the classroom where the gunman was held up, but they did not communicate with one another, the report found. Despite a search for the master key to the classroom by the school police chief, Pete Arredondo, and others, no one called the principal, who had one. The usefulness of a specialized tool to pry the door open was tested, but rejected as too dangerous to the officers. The chief of Uvalde Police Department called from his vacation to tell the acting chief, Lieutenant Pargas, to set up a command post. Mr. Pargas did so in office at a funeral home across the street, but left shortly thereafter. This did not result in the establishment of an effective command post, the report found. The report found that four ballistic shields brought to the scene. Only the last shield furnished by U.S. Marshals was rifle rated, and it arrived at 12:21 p.m., nearly 50 minutes after the shooting began. The finding served to clarify and solidify what had been frequently shifting official accounts of the events that happened at the school. The report found that one reason that the flawed information made its way into an initial news conference held by Governor Greg Abbott the day after the shooting was that the Uvalde police lieutenant who had been at the scene was supposed to brief the governor, literally passing out while waiting in the hallway beforehand. A regional director for the state and police held a brief instead, but information was secondhand, the report also said. Still, the facts of what unfolded were unclear, even to some of the participants, the report found. For example, one of the first officers at the school, a Uvalde police officer armed with an AR-15 style rifle himself, arrived to the sound of gunfire and saw a person dressed in black. The officer took cover, believing the person was the gunman, and later told the other officers who responded that the investigators that he had tried not that he had tried to fire at the person. I had not tried to fire at the person because of the children nearby, but the person had not been the gunman, the report found, but rather a school coach hustling children to safety. False information spread among the officers who arrived outside, according to the report, and likely prevented some of them from taking more assertive roles. The committee reached a more expansive conclusion about the nature of the failures than the one offered by the director of the state police, Steve McCraw, who placed the blame in his public statement squarely on Mr. Arredondo. The report found that the egregious and poor decision-making went beyond Mr. Arredondo and included the dozen of well-armed officers from Mr. McCraw's own agency, the Department of Public Safety, as well as scores from the U.S. Border Patrol spokesmen for both agencies that did not respond to requests for comment. Now, while many others interviewed by the committee said that they consider Mr. Arredondo to be the incident commander, others said that they were not aware who was in charge. The report said creating a chaotic vacuum of leadership that a larger state and federal agencies could have moved to fill, but did not. Quote, despite an obvious atmosphere of chaos, the ranking officers, other agencies did not approach the Uvalde CISD chief of police, the report said, referring to Ms. Arredondo, or anyone else perceived to be in command to point out the lack and the need for a command post or the other, or for any other specific assistance. Yet even as details became clear, the large contours of what was known about the deadly event remained the same. The gunman entered the school without being confronted by any officer through one of the three exterior doors that were not locked, and went directly to the classrooms where he began shooting. A lockdown alert was sent to the school staff at the school, according to the report, but the staff might not have acted with urgency during the lockdown because of frequent alerts related to nearby police chases and deliberate crashes of vehicles suspected to be carrying undocumented immigrants, known as bailouts,
not seeing any injured students in the hallway. On one sergeant told the committee he thought it might be a bailout situation, the report said. Still, as seen on the surveillance video released as part of the report, local police officers, including Ms. Arredondo, arrived minutes later but retreated down the hallway after being met with gunfire at the door to one of the classrooms. Even as more heavily armored officers arrived along with ballistic shields, they did not attempt to enter the classroom again for over an hour. That was the wrong decision, Mr. Recross said in the days after, saying the call to do so had been made by Ms. Arredondo, who said, who they said was the on-scene incident commander. Now, Mr. Arredondo told the committee that he did not consider himself to be in that role during the massacre and thought someone else would take that role. But the committee found that he should have been the incident commander based on the school's districts and the school's response plan for shootings, which calls for the school's police chief to become the person in control of the efforts of all law enforcement and first responders who arrive on the scene. Mr. Arredondo, in his own interview with the committee, said he might have acted to breach the classroom sooner had he known there were still victims alive inside. Quote, we probably would have rallied a little more to say, okay, someone is in there, he told the committee. The police chief periodically attempted to communicate with the gunman, both in English and in Spanish, the report said, including immediately after four shots were fired inside the classroom. Mr. Ramos, can you hear us? Mr. Ramos, please respond. Mr. Arredondo could be heard saying, according to the transcripts reviewed by the New York Times. Now, the breakdown in communication was such that the acting Uvalde Police Chief, Lieutenant Pargas, told the committee that he was never in communication with Mr. Arredondo at all. By the time the specialized Border Patrol agents known as BORTAC and others breached the classroom, the reports found tactical command inside the building had been de facto assumed by BORTAC. The three-member committee that prepared the report included the two state House members, Mr. Burroughs and Lubach, a Republican, and Joe Moody, an El Paso Democrat, as well as a former state Supreme Court Justice, Eva Guzman, who recently ran an unsuccessful Republican primary bid for Attorney General. Now, during a solemn meeting with the committee on Sunday before the report's public release, more than 40 relatives and 21 victims asked methodical questions about the committee's work and more definitive timeline of events, said Arnulfo Reyes, a teacher who survived the shooting and attended the meeting. Jesus Rizos, the uncle of one of the victims, said he was struck by most of the lack of leadership at the time when the school children needed help the most. And he's the uncle of Jackie Cavaras. That was one of the victims. Now, the highlight was an inadequate response to failures of leadership, Mr. Rizzo said. Leonardo Sandoval, who was the grandson of Xavier Lopez, died on the way to the hospital after being shot at Robb Elementary School, and said the reports laid bare what the community had long known, that officers failed to stop the shooter in time and then release misleading information to the public. Xavier, he later learned he suffered a single shot in the back of the head, or a single shot in the back, and was alive when the officers finally breached the classroom. He was pronounced dead at the hospital, Sandoval said. We all make mistakes, we're all human, but they should have admitted it and then resigned, Mr. Sandoval said. It's the lying that hurts. Got a friend that always says, it's not the truth that I'm afraid of, but it's the lie that worries me. This was just a, it wasn't just a failure of leadership, even though it is a massive cover up after it. That is true. And the only way to get the answers that we want on this specific situation is to do the painful thing and release the entire 77-minute video, to release the complete video from when the gunman goes into the school and all the footage from the hallway and all the transcripts. And that is the only way you're going to have any transparency, because, of course, the institutions are going to lie and are going to protect themselves and there's going to be the blue wall of silence. Not just that, they don't want, the state does not want to take accountability. They don't want these federal agencies to get sued. And then there's even a question, is that possible with the qualified immunity that a lot of these agencies end up getting? So that was, that bombshell report came out, and that's something that is going to be a stain and a failure on those agencies for a long time to come, a very long time to come. There is a bitter fight going on now. Of course, we have the primaries coming up, but over the abortion thing. There's a story that I'm not going to cover, but I'm going to mention. And I'm not going to cover it because I find it off-putting and somewhat disgusting. But this is exactly what happened. There was a 10-year-old in Ohio who was pregnant. The 10-year-old obviously started to have sexual contact with someone who was a undocumented immigrant when she was 9 years old. She got pregnant, and because of the new laws on Roe v. Wade, she could not have an abortion legally in Ohio. So after the parents became aware, they took the child to Indiana and got the procedure done in Indiana. When this story came out, the initial response was from the left was, this is what's going to happen. This is what these type of laws stop, from being safe, safe path to take care of this procedure. And people are going to have to can have this medical tourism. The right, the Fox News right, said that the story did not exist. They didn't believe it. Well, if you want to look it up now, it has been confirmed. The police are involved. The man was arrested. And the response from the officials, the governors, the senators, etc., from Ohio, is they want to see if they have the right to arrest the doctor in Indiana for doing the procedure. Imagine that is the world that we are living in right now. This is the craziest timeline to be alive. A 9-year-old is raped, pregnant by the age of 10. The doctor terminates the pregnancy. We have to see if we can arrest the doctor. That's who did the other wrong in that situation. What did you actually think? What person thinks a 10-year-old should carry a baby to term? I wanted you guys to write me in on this to see if I'm off basis. How is this child going to support this other child? This is when you have these types of 50-year changes, in a law, these climactic cultural shifts. This is when I made the statement where I said you can be pro or anti whatever, but it is what happens when your policy meets real life, and that's when the questions become way more complicated. This decision just happened. We're still reckoning with it, and already an example of what happens when this type of law is abolished is already come. And this abortion fight is actually coming to the Senate and to the House floors. Legislative battles over abortion access are heating up in House and Senate everywhere. because, of course, Democrats look to raise pressure on Republicans around the bills aimed at protecting abortion access that were introduced by Democrats were considered on Capitol Hill last week, leading to the first instances of lawmakers butting heads over such legislation since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade last month. So now, though the bills are said to be unlikely to pass in the evenly divided Senate, where they are required the bipartisan support to overcome the legislative filibuster, Democrats are pushing for the action in the aftermath of the court's decision and seeking to get Republican members of Congress on the record of objecting to legislation on the issues, an apparent attempt to paint the GOP lawmakers as going to the extremes to stop abortions. Now, Republicans have, in turn, accused Democrats of fear-mongering that when they argue that the GOP will seek to block access to contraceptives and try to enact a nationwide abortion ban. Now, a bill that codified protections for abortion access into federal law, the Women's Health Protection Act, was passed by the House by 2019 and 2009. That was a vote almost entirely along party lines on Friday after previously being approved by the chamber in September. Democratic Rep. Henry Culler from Texas voted against the measure along with Republican members, apart from the two who did not vote. Now, Republican lawmakers lambasted the legislation as a form of government overreach during the debate over it on Friday, with several members referring to it as Abortion on Demand Until Birth Act. Republican Rep. Kathy McMorris Rogers argued it stripped away states' laws that protected women from coercion to terminate their pregnancies and claim it would force physicians to perform abortions. Wow, what a stupid ass argument. I don't know if there is any, besides, I guess if you were 8, 9, 10, I don't know if there's really people who go around trying to coerce people to have pregnancies terminated. I don't think that exists. So anyway, the House also on Friday passed a bill 223-205 that will protect the out-of-state travel for abortion services, with three Republicans, Rep. Brian Fitzpatrick, Adam Kissinger, and Fred Upton, joining Democrats in voting for the measure. So Democratic lawmakers slammed their GOP colleagues for opposing the bill. Quote, "It is absolutely important to get Republicans on the record to how far they will go to restrict a woman's rights," said Rep. Judy Cho, the Democrat from California. And she told that to The Hill. "Are they really saying that women should not be allowed to travel to another state to get a medical procedure?" And of course, that's going to be one of the underlying questions that's asked. I know women who travel to other states all the time to get certain medical procedures, whether they are medically necessities or they are cosmetic. You got a friend who traveled from Virginia to Florida recently to get a breast procedure. I know friends who have gone to Puerto Rico to get procedures. I know friends who have gone to South Korea to get medical procedures. I know Canadians who have come here to get major surgeries. And I also know Americans who have gone to Canada to get certain things. Look, I know frequent steroid users who go to Europe when they want to cycle on. I've seen this type of medical tourism stuff before over certain things. Famously, there was the event where Senator Bernie Sanders went to Canada with a bunch of cancer patients to try to get them health care there. And there was the latest one where they went to Canada, and this again was Senator Bernie Sanders, to get the diabetics insulin, and they were showing that the insulin was so much cheaper. I think it was like $11 to get the insulin medication there, and it was hundreds of dollars here. So that is what's gonna, if
Yeah, if that's the road we're going down, we're going to tell people not only what medical procedures they can and can't get, we're going to tell them that even if it's legal in another state, they can't go there to get it. That is going to be a fight to be had, because it'll be one of the only medical procedures that we block people from getting, you know. And that's going to ask you that enforcement question again. You know, how is that going to work out? But anyway, you know, why would it stop there? If say alcohol is legal, is illegal, we make it illegal in these 15 states, would it be reasonable that if you go to another state to get it, the state you go back to charges you for the behavior that you participated in the other state? That's the type of road that seems to be going down with these different laws that mean something here but don't mean something there. You get in a very dangerous, tricky situation. I think I've told the personal anecdote before when it came to guns. When I lived in Washington, D.C., and the job I had was in Alexandria, Virginia. Well, guns needed for the job. The guns are perfectly legal, and the magazines are perfectly legal in Virginia. And then about 20 minutes up the street, every magazine I owned was illegal, and I had no ability and no rights to carry a gun into the District of Columbia. 20 minutes away. Completely different laws. So if I'm somebody who is trying to, you know, obey the law as much as I can, you jump through the hoops, you do what's necessary. But there are a lot of people who just are going to flat out ignore it. Flat out ignore the law until they get smacked by it. Then there's, of course, a backlash to that. Now, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the Democrat of California, and Communications Director Henry Conley tweeted shortly after the vote, generally very scary that 205 House Republicans just voted to enable states to arrest, fine, or sue women for traveling to get an abortion, even where it's still legal, end quote. Now, the GOP's opposition means both bills are unlikely to pass in an evenly divided Senate. Well, they will need 60 votes to overcome the filibuster. The upper chambers have already failed to pass the Women's Health Protection Act twice in September. And this week, a Republican senator blocked a separate bill seeking to protect those traveling across state lines to get abortions. Democratic senators on Tuesday unveiled legislation that would bar state legislators from banning restrictive interstate travel to obtain abortions in the states where they are still allowed. The bill was quickly brought up for unanimous consent vote on the Senate floor just days after it was introduced, only to be blocked by the Republican James Lackford of Oklahoma. Lackford sought to center debate over the bill of life of a fetus and say remarks opposing the legislation. The conversation today is not just about women. There are two people in this conversation, a child with 10 fingers and 10 toes, a beating heartbeat, a DNA that is uniquely different than the mom's DNA or the dad's DNA. Democratic lawmakers, in contrast, look to emphasize the rights of pregnant people. Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown from Ohio and Kristen Gillibrand from New York both described the bill as protecting privacy rights, with Gillibrand explicitly saying it was not about a medical procedure, but about the privacy of four pregnant people, as well as their freedom to travel across state lines. A number of Democrats, including President Biden, have called for the Senate to carve out an exception to the filibuster to qualify abortion rights after Roe was overturned. Cho, the sponsor of the Women's Health Protection Act, reiterated her support for eliminating the filibuster in order to pass the bill, blaming the Senate. Two Republicans, pro-abortion gun rights members, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, for it being stalled. A change to a filibuster will require the support of all 50 Democratic senators. However, Senator Joe Manchin, the Democrat from West Virginia, and Kristen Sinema have opposed altering the rules. You know, Republicans have this very cute thing they say. There's a term that's called rhino. Republican in names only. I want to get in circulation the word dino, you know, dino. Democrat in name only.
How about that? And that's what I think of when I think of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. I say those two are dinos. They are Democrats in name only. But anyway, so as the congressional Democrats seek to pass abortion protections, party leaders such as Biden and Pelosi have been encouraging Americans to vote in the upcoming midterms in order to ensure abortion access. Of course, now this is just me, but you know, I'll say that after this. But anyway, Biden criticized the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe earlier the month, saying the court now practically dares the women of America to go to the ballot box and restore the very rights that they've just taken away. The president had previously called on voters to elect more pro-abortion rights lawmakers when the Women's Health Protection Act failed to pass in the Senate's votes earlier. We actually need to do all things, Joe said in the multiple approaches Democrats are talking to protect abortion access. Democrats are taking to protect abortion access. There have been marches and demonstrations and rallies all across America on a continuous basis for 3 weeks. We need to do all this. Also, we need to point to the elections. All right, so now, what I was going to say in response to the Speaker of the House, the steward of the Democratic Party, Nancy Pelosi, and to all the other Democrats who keep saying, we got to vote, we got to vote, we got to vote. My thing is, that may be true, but here's the thing. They've already done that. They voted for Jimmy Carter. He could have codified Roe v. Wade. He did. They voted for Bill Clinton. The problem was still there. He could have codified Roe v. Wade. He was very popular president. They loved him on the economy, but he didn't. They elected Barack Obama. He had a supermajority. He could have codified Roe v. Wade, but he didn't. And now they have elected Joe Biden, and the Supreme Court has dared them, the Democrats, to codify Roe v. Wade, and they're not. I have grown more frustrated and more tired over the past few months, but it's been a evolving process over the years. People who are in power, when they get in power, constantly saying what they cannot do unless you get more of them in power. I'm tired of them kneeling and putting on the dashikis and reading poems and going to marches. There is for people in the community to do. It is your job to legislate. It's not like we didn't know this was coming. This has been a 50-year battle. Everybody knew this was coming. Everybody was saying it. You had everybody when the law was in existence. You even from your Focus on the Families group to the Moral Majority to the Right to Life movement. They have been saying what the goal was for years. The fact that these people were caught off-footed from a battle that they had told you that they were going after for 50 years is astonishing. And it's crazy if you think about that in the context of most of the people who sit in these halls of power have been there for 30 and 40 years. So there's no reason that if they believe what they said that they believe in, that this should have not already been taken care of. There's a famous little ditty that I think Nancy Pelosi even likes to say. Show me your policy and I'll show you your values. Yeah, there you go. for 50 years, you knew this was coming, and for 50 years, you didn't do anything about it. And now, you're telling people to go out and do what they had already went out and done. It's a very interesting thing in the Hill, and I may leave it in the show notes, but it was kind of goes down that line as well, where it's like Barack Obama could have done this and a lot more things had he just asked Harry Reid to do it. When Harry Reid was over the Senate, and Mitch McConnell and Republicans had their record number of filibusters, right? Remember that? Filibustered almost every damn thing that they were trying to do. Harry Reid, if Obama would have asked him, he would have ended the filibuster for almost all legislation, including on judges. And Merrick Garland could have got a seat on the court. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg should have retired. And then Obama would have got to pick another justice on the court. And you would not be sitting here right now. So that's that. There's also another path that all that can happen. Merrick Garland can get his nomination. Mitch McConnell's not holding it up. Ruth Bader Ginsburg retires instead of dying on the bench. You get that seat. And then you still have a supermajority, so you still codify it into law by legislating, by doing the job you were sent there to do. So, obviously, this may work as a tactic. People are upset. They galvanize. People don't like not being in power. People don't like when they feel like they have something taken away. It's going to be a real test, because normally what happens, I think Reagan lost the Senate in the midterms. Carter lost the Senate in the midterms. I think Clinton lost the Senate in the midterms. Obama lost the Senate in the midterms. Bush either lost the Senate or the House in the midterms. So if history keeps it that trajectory, then Biden is supposed to lose the Senate. And then you'll have the real divided power. Republicans will have the Senate. Democrats will have the House and the presidency. Republicans obviously have the court at the moment, even though the court, pretends to be a nonpartisan endeavor. But we all know that's a bunch of silliness. But anyway, so Democrats will have the presidency. Republicans will have the Senate. Democrats will have the House. That's how it's supposed to be going. If this is an issue that people are furious about and fired up about, then that may change. And Democrats may actually have a chance of holding on to the Senate. But my question is, and then what? What are they going to do about it? What are they going to do about this type of thing? The story that I'm going to start off with tomorrow somewhat tried to answer that question, but many young Democrats are furious at Democrats, but they're going to push through anyway. And it's going to be college liberals who helped elect President Biden. They face their own rage with the party, and they're urging peers, but they are still urging their peers to support. So that tomorrow's show will start off with that, and then they'll do some election stuff, some horse race politics stuff, the 2024, Biden's best hope for 2024. Surprisingly, what they say Biden's best hope is, and Biden's visit to Saudi Arabia, et cetera, et cetera. So that'll be on the next episode. At any rate, you know I always try to lead you to the T-Bone and Chick Brew show. If you got other podcast needs, it's not a political show.
It's just a conversation. They do a weekly boost or a daily boost. They talk about cuisine. One of them is a chef. One of them is a comedian. So both Navy veterans. So give the show a shot. The T-Bone and Chick Burr Show. Very entertaining podcast. You can find that the same place you found this one. And we're going to see you back on the next episode. We'll probably do more this week. Try to get back in the groove of doing this stuff. We got the midterms coming up. And we're going to have a lot to talk about.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Of course, if you want to support the show, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com and getting a membership for as little as $3 a month. Again, that's www.patreon.com/The Darrell McLean Show. The Darrell McLean Show is fully listener-supported, independent media that won't lead you to tribalism. Get a membership and support independent media at www.patreon.com/The Darrell McLean Show.